Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks for listening this week. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, any news junkie knows that sound. It's that ticking clock leading off 60 Minutes every Sunday night from CBS News, the longest-running television news program in history. And last Sunday, 60 Minutes focus fell on Florida.
For 3 months, we've been reporting around Palm Beach County, the third largest in the state. It's home to old-money millionaires, but also some of the poorest day laborers and farm workers in America.
In all, the news report ran 13 minutes examining the early weeks of Governor Ron DeSantis' vaccination strategy, including distributing vaccines to Publix pharmacies. The report made this inference.
So why did the governor choose Publix? Campaign finance reports obtained by 60 Minutes show that weeks before the governor's announcement, Publix donated $100,000 to his political action committee, Friends of Ron DeSantis. Julie Jenkins Fancelli, heiress to the Publix fortune, has given $55,000 to the governor's PAC in the past, and in November, Fancelli's brother-in-law, Hoyt R. Barnett, a retired Publix executive, donated $25,000.
The best they could come up with is a half-baked conspiracy theory that literally is readily debunked by talking to, like, two people.
This was the governor on Wednesday this week. For 20 minutes and with PowerPoint slides, he tried to refute the 60 Minutes report. The Republican governor was joined by his outgoing emergency management director, Democrat Jared Moskowitz, who used a favorite word of President Joe Biden to describe the Publix pay-to-play politics accusation.
I told them that this Publix narrative was malarkey, and they still went with it.
Now, the governor has been aggressive all along in defending his pandemic strategy, from focusing on seniors first to get the vaccine. That was in defiance of CDC guidelines, to reopening schools last summer, for example. And he knows hitting the news media helps score points with his core supporters.
This is bad for our country to have big corporate media smearing for profit just because I'm in the other party than them, and using their partisanship to craft narratives regardless of the facts.
So what are the facts? What do you think about all this? The 60 Minutes report lacked hard evidence to support the central pay-to-play claim, but the state has steered vaccine doses to certain areas that include DeSantis donors and supporters. Phones are open now statewide, 305-995-1800. 305-995-1800. You can also hit us up on social media. Look for us on Twitter at Florida Roundup.
Now, we should note the DeSantis administration has refused to release all of the records surrounding contacts like emails and phone calls and also contracts made by the governor and his team. And that would spell out to the media exactly how communities and vendors were all selected to get vaccines. And let's also note it's long been a criticism that Publix stores are located often in more affluent areas, and people in underserved communities, in the initial months especially, did have trouble reaching them on public transportation to obtain a vaccine. That's something the 60 Minutes report showed. We're going to discuss all of this more now as we welcome two guests, Mark Caputo of Politico and University of South Florida Associate Professor in the Department of Communication, Joshua Scacco. Guys, good to have you on the show. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much.
Thanks so much. Professor Scacco, let's begin with you. Let's begin. There's a lot to get into when it comes to the 60 Minutes story. It covered several different issues. But let's begin with the allegations about the governor and Publix. 60 Minutes pointed out that Publix made donations to DeSantis. They suggested there was a possible link between the donation and the state's partnership with Publix stores for the vaccine distribution. Now, that's the part of the 60 Minutes piece that the governor and his supporters are pushing back on the loudest. What do the facts show?
Well, one of the key things that I think is important here is that there is the perception or the inference created between or the connection of the donation or set of donations and then the governor's actions. Unfortunately, the report from 60 Minutes doesn't necessarily connect the dots with firm evidence that the donation led to particular actions in terms of public selection. And so what 60 Minutes invites really is a unclear inference for people to make about this sort of pay to play. And so what the governor is up against here is the governor is up against the perception of something that really in a lot of ways happens in politics quite a bit, which is that you have corporations, they make donations to political leaders. Political leaders in turn make decisions that sometimes benefit or not their donors. That doesn't necessarily mean there's an explicit connection. So he's up against this sort of correlation does not imply causation here.
Right. The report didn't necessarily make a hard connection between the donations and the governor's decision to use Publix for distribution. He has been vocal along with his allies in saying that there were other vaccine distribution sites in the early months and that the report was misleading. That said, Mark Caputo, let's bring you into the discussion. The piece also talked about the controversy regarding tourists flying into Florida to get the vaccine in the early days of the pandemic. It showed how poorer communities have had trouble accessing the vaccines. It pointed out that critics called the state's response in the early days like the Wild West or even the Hunger Games. What were your thoughts about those pieces of the story?
Well, my thoughts overall is that 60 Minutes has proven itself to be kind of a trashy news organization. It was a terrible report. I hope you don't mind me disagreeing with you guys. This wasn't an inference about pay to play. There was a specific question from a CBS or 60 Minutes reporter who actually says on camera, and it makes it into the package, quote, this is pay to play. That's not an inference. It's a direct accusation.
She said, how is this not pay to play? That's what she said.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, you know.
Yeah, but she used those words. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I mean, it's not a suggestion of correlation and causation. I mean, it's as direct as, it's almost as direct as you can. And it was just, it was a trashy, cheap report. It pretended it had this inside information. We've obtained, 60 Minutes said, these campaign finance logs as if it's some secret. It's on the internet, right? And it also had been reported in various places, including Twitter, and by legitimate news organizations that were actually legitimately reporting it out. You know, as a reporter who's based in Florida and who's had to, you know, wound up covering pandemic politics, I've really been astonished at the sloppiness, the bias of mainly New York-based national news media in covering Florida. Remember, they were the same people who were pumping out stuff like Florida morons at the beaches, like don't go to the beach in Florida, it's dangerous. Turned out it wasn't wrong, and DeSantis was right about that. At the same time, the governor in New York was making some pretty terrible decisions, and it turns out covering up data. But Florida, for some reason, got a lot more attention about it. That's not to let Ron DeSantis off the hook. The reality is his administration has stonewalled reporters time and time again, as you mentioned.
Yeah. It's been remarkable that the whole bit about Publix has gotten a lot of the attention. And I think
it's easy and cheap.
Yeah.
And what it does is it plays to people's confirmation biases and their partisan leanings.
But let me just finish my thought, if I could, and get you both to comment on the fact that the Publix bit of the piece has gotten a lot of attention. But as you pointed out, Mark, Florida reporters for many months now have been covering this whole pandemic response in a granular way. The governor has been facing accusations of vaccine favoritism for some time. Earlier this year, there were some pop-up sites in wealthy enclaves that drew a lot of criticism. Text messages that were made public showed the governor's office coordinated some of those events with campaign donors and supporters. Florida Democrats want a federal investigation into this. Professor Scacco, the story didn't get as deeply into those controversies for some reason, but those really have had more validity behind them than what Mark is pointing out about the other stuff.
Well, and when you talk about validity, I think that, again, we're talking about perception here, perception that wealthier communities have gotten this. And that's been backed up by the data in some ways, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the data is unique to Florida in any kind of way. What we're seeing is that just as in many other aspects of the pandemic and healthcare in the United States in general, that the initial benefits of the vaccines and things also flowed and also went along kind of socioeconomic lines. And so you see these systemic disparities happen. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that there was a deliberate effort to engage in one sort of actions or another. What it does indicate is that the systemic disparities that were in place before in our healthcare system also get exacerbated in a moment like this, when vaccines are being rolled out in a relatively rapid manner to try to meet the needs of as many people as possible. That is, in one way, messaging that the governor hasn't been able to address as well when it comes to this question of equity and access.
We are talking about the 60 Minutes report about Florida and the early weeks of the governor's distribution of vaccines under question. The governor really pushing back considerably to the 60 Minutes report. 305-995-1800, 305-995-1800, or at Florida Roundup on Twitter. Zach sent us this note: while DeSantis has not had the best response overall to the pandemic, for example, no statewide mask mandate, executive orders taking away county and city rights for fining offenders to their mandates, the 60 Minutes interview's timing is terrible, considering the opening availability of the vaccines now. Let's go to Kathy in Sarasota on line four. Kathy, thanks for listening, and thanks for calling. You're on the radio.
I think 60 Minutes is proving they're not any better than CNN. I think they're proving that they're, like the man said, a trash organization. They did pick on DeSantis, but because they have the Democratic backers who are all misdirected. Let's see, talk about managing stuff. Where's their president on the border with children actually dying there? Okay? And DeSantis did the best thing he could do in Florida. Publix is ubiquitous. And it's one of the best choices he could make. Other than that, he needed to have a group to say, well, where are some people that cannot reach the public? Maybe he could have gotten buses there, and maybe those communities should have notified the health department. DeSantis can only be in so many places at one time. As far as favoring Lakewood Ranch, it's another older people's community, so it wasn't really being so prejudiced. They're old as the hills out in Lakewood Ranch, okay? It was a good place to start.
Oh, Kathy, you dropped out of your cell there from Sarasota. Sorry, but we got the gist of certainly the strong impression and the strong opinions you've got in Sarasota. Let's go to Jason in Jacksonville. Jason, you're on the radio now.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. Hi, Melissa. I call her show regularly.
Hey, Jason.
I just have a very interesting comment here. I'm sorry, but the deep and profound irony of Ron DeSantis complaining about a media company, quote unquote, smearing him with false information and allegations. And my question when I first called him was, does he simply stand up on a podium and pontificate and then walk away? Because the question I would ask him is, how does he think it has affected the United States and our profound, wonderful love of this country with all the misinformation that was spewed for months by the former president? I mean, the irony here is deep, and I'm wondering if he has any idea or ever gets feedback, or if reporters are asking him questions like, well, sir, you know, what do you think about the misinformation that was done and all the smearing of one political party by, let's say, a Fox News organization? That's my comment.
Yeah, Jason, I appreciate that. Mark Caputo, I can't imagine the irony here is lost at all on the Ivy League trained lawyer who is the governor of the state of Florida, although he may not see it as irony in this case.
Right. There's a dysfunctional relationship between the Republican Party and the media, and specifically the national media. And the 60 Minutes report did nothing to disabuse us of that situation. I think it's important to note that, yeah, it's true, DeSantis did involve himself in helping rich communities. But, you know, one of the things, like, for instance, Jared Moskowitz had told me the other day, he's the Division of Emergency Management head in Florida. He's a Democrat. You know, he talked about they knocked on 150,000 doors of poor people, mainly in communities of color. They only had 10% of them converted to appointments. The 60 Minutes story left out, for instance, that in early February,
DeSantis personally teamed up with Anquan Boldin, the former FSU and NFL star from Pahokee, to vaccinate black people in the community. More than 60% of Pahokee's population is black, but while it's true that DeSantis went out of his way to help rich, exclusive, and heavily, if not almost exclusively white communities, his administration has actually done a lot or attempted to do a lot to vaccinate poorer communities as well. And the unfortunate thing, and this is on some of my fellow Florida reporting brethren, that story should have been told at least at the same time in some degree to point out, hey, it's not like DeSantis is just involving himself in this one thing. And, you know, as reporters, we need to call it fair and we need to call it straight. And back to 60 Minutes, the trouble with that is when you look at, when you listen to what that first caller said, is it's going to justify her opinion on just not trusting anything any of us do. And
you know, going beyond that, we're almost coming up to a break, Mark, but going beyond that, how does this whole flap play into the governor's hands, given that, as many of you know that cover him, he has presidential aspirations?
In fact, when I asked him about it, I was the first reporter to write about how DeSantis' stock was rising in the national GOP as a potential candidate. I asked him here in Miami, where I'm based, hey, has the negative media attention about the coronavirus and your response to it in Florida, is that the cause of your rising popularity in the GOP? And he said 100%, and he chuckled, and he said 100%. Basically, folks like 60 Minutes and some of these other media organizations are essentially creating Ron DeSantis GOP 2024 presidential frontrunner. Congratulations, guys.
Lots of tweets, by the way. Thank you. Let's close with Joshua, and Mark will stick around. What are your final thoughts about this, Joshua? Because let's be clear, the vaccine is now available to everyone in the state. This story focused on the early days of the pandemic and controversies in the earlier months of the rollout.
So one of the things we're seeing in, with the initial set of callers is that this story is playing into people's priors about Ron DeSantis, about how the political parties have handled the public health crisis over the past year. And unfortunately, one of the key components here is from the polling data, from the survey data, that there is some more reluctancy for the vaccines in the Republican Party. And so the concern, obviously, is that a more conservative individuals, Republicans, will look at a story like this and will equate these types of, you know, accusations and these types of stories with maybe additional justification not to get the vaccine. And so that is, I think, something that we have to look, we have to look out for. And that's also something that in some ways, when the governor uses kind of the strategy of taking umbrage with media reports, as a way of stoking the base.
Stoking here. And we're out of time. But that's certainly what happened. Thank you, Joshua Scacco, professor, associate professor of communication at FSU, and Mark Caputo staying with us for the hour.
Another Florida Republican in the headlines this week, Matt Gaetz. We'll talk about the controversy surrounding the congressman next.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for listening this Friday. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz says he will not resign. But more damaging revelations keep coming out about Gaetz, the panhandle firebrand, who's been a strong supporter of former President Donald Trump.
Now, Gaetz is caught up in a federal investigation. It's looking into allegations that he had a sexual relationship with a 17-year-old girl and paid for her when they traveled together. Gaetz is 38 years old. Now, we need to note he denies all of these accusations, and he has not been charged yet with any crime. Gaetz is scheduled to headline a dinner tonight for Women for America First. That's a pro-Trump group at the Trump National Doral in South Florida. dinner and drinks for the evening called BBQ Boots and Bluegrass with Gates cost $500 a head.
Gates has become enmeshed in an investigation into former Seminole County tax collector Joel Greenberg. Greenberg faces 33 federal charges, including stalking, wire fraud, and sex trafficking of a minor. In a brief court hearing in Orlando on Thursday, Greenberg's lawyer and federal prosecutors told the judge they expect him to strike a plea deal. The Daily Beast reported on Friday that Greenberg received $900 from Gates in May of 2018 over the banking app Venmo. Greenberg then sent three young women, one who was 18 years old at the time, a total of $900.
We're continuing the conversation now with Mark Caputo of Politico, still with us, and joining the show as well, Mary Ellen Kloss, Capitol Bureau Chief for the Miami Herald. It's 305-995-1800. Already getting your tweets. Send them to @FloridaRoundup. Mary Ellen, where to begin here? Federal investigators looking into whether Gates paid women to travel to the Bahamas for sex, NBC News says. They're looking into whether Gates and Greenberg used the internet to search for women they could pay for sex. Tom mentioned the activity on Venmo. Lots of evidence, but we need to point out Gates says he has never paid for sex or had sex with a minor. So what evidence is there to support this federal probe, and what are you reporting about this today?
Well, there's. Thanks for letting me on. I wanted to just kind of underscore what you said. There are no charges yet. However, there is a lot of smoke. So it's pretty clear that there are a lot of questions here. Just the idea that they are questioning women and whether they had sex with men on a trip in the Bahamas. And, these are people who operate with a lot of, they have access to a lot of money. And, were these trips in exchange for money, or were they, as Matt Gaetz has said, just being a really generous boyfriend? It's illegal to engage in sex in exchange for something of value. I mean, that is the bottom line of what these claims are trying to get at.
Mm-hmm. Mark Caputo, you wrote in Politico about how Matt Gaetz' friendship with the former Seminole County tax collector Joel Greenberg pulled him into this spiraling investigation. This was a close friendship between two men became quite lurid, according to your reporting. What did you discover?
Right. Well, their friendship was built on mutual ideology. Both young 30-something guys, some people object to me calling 30-something young. I'm 40, pardon my
it's
bias.
It's pretty young.
they liked to have sex with young women. So from what we were able to piece out in talking to friends, associates, and various people who understand the investigation, is that Greenberg would meet these women on the website seeking arrangement. And Mary Ellen said something very interesting, which is that you're not allowed to pay for sex, but there are gray areas. And Seeking Arrangement is a website where women, usually young women, meet older men with money, sugar daddies. And there is a relationship there where sex does happen and where things of value change hands, but it's legal. When you move over to the accusations, the allegations that Gates faces, from what we're able to discover and what we at Politico first reported, the 17-year-old in question here, she's no longer 17. She probably turned 18 in November 2017. She went on to work in the sex industry. She's a pornography worker, a porn star. Greenberg is charged with having had sex. We don't know if Gates is directly accused of having had sex with her when she was 17, or if the federal sex trafficking statute ropes him in because he was complicit in helping or conspiring, essentially, to help Greenberg have sex with her. After she turned 18, the Daily Beast reported that Gates, in sending money to Greenberg, specifically mentioned this young woman, she was 18 at the time, her first name. She, according to our reporting, also went on this Bahamas trip. So we have the common threads here we have, and Greenberg wasn't on it, because there's a relationship Greenberg allegedly had, according to indictment, with a sexual relationship with a 17-year-old. Then she turns 18. She apparently winds up on this Bahamas trip where Greenberg isn't. Some prosecutors or people associated with the investigation are telling other media organizations that they're classifying the women, that's plural, who went on this trip as escorts. If they are considered escorts, and if the activity they did there was considered prostitution, then it would violate the Mann Act, which essentially prohibits someone from transporting a person over state lines to have sex. So we've essentially got two things. We have a sex with a minor, a sex trafficking issue with a minor, and then we have kind of a broader sex trafficking issue with a prostitute. The difficulty here, to circle back and wrap up, is at what point does something turn from a relationship where things of value change hands legally versus an arrangement of prostitution? And that's what investigators are going to be figuring out. They're taking testimony from people, and they're obviously building a case, trying to convict Gates.
Yeah, and part of that case, Mark, is could be coming from Greenberg, the former Seminole County tax collector, who we learned yesterday is negotiating some kind of plea deal with federal prosecutors, potentially in exchange, right, for information of some kind related to whatever is else included in the 33 federal charges that he currently faces.
Right. He's, you know, and that's true. And he, and his testimony could be very key here, as well as the former 17-year-old, the woman, one of the women at the center of this case. But remember this about Greenberg. Not only is he charged with having sex with a 17-year-old and with a host of financial crimes, the first crime he committed that led to this entire investigation was he falsely smeared a rival as a pedophile. That's going to be a difficult witness to have on the stand if it gets to that. To say, oh, yeah, I falsely smeared this other guy as a pedophile. And, yeah, I was, I don't know if it's considered pedophilia or not specifically, but I had sex with this minor over here. But, you know, it's put in Matt Gates. That's, you know, that's a thing that prosecutors are going to look at in building their case. Like, how credible is this witness? Now, if they have enough witnesses and a critical mass, you know, certainly bad for Gates. You know, these are things we're going to see unfold over time.
We're talking here on the Florida Roundup about the federal investigation into Panhandle Congressman Matt Gaetz. 305-995-1800 to join us. Flavin is in Tallahassee calling in. Flavin, or Flavi, rather. How are you? Go ahead.
I'm wonderful. Thank you so much for asking. I'm just calling in today because I just think it's funny that we are talking about all of this, possible child sex trafficking, possible sex with a minor, all these things with Republican Matt Gaetz, and the spokesperson for child crimes in Congress, QAnon, hasn't said a word. I just think it's funny that they've been pushing this massive theory that Congress is behind all of this giant child sex trafficking ring, and yet when a prominent member of the Republican Party is having some questions around him for child sex trafficking and having sex with a minor, they don't see any correlation somehow with that, or they don't want to say anything about that because he's a Republican. I just think it's very funny that they haven't said anything about this entire situation.
Flavi, thanks. Mary Ellen Kloss, you know, Matt Gaetz hasn't really had any prominent defenders in Congress, although former President Trump did issue a very carefully worded statement defending Gaetz. And I think part of the reason there's so much interest in this is, as the caller pointed out, Matt Gaetz has really been a firebrand in terms of his strong support for the president, and also his comments related to the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol. The caller brought up QAnon. And so how do you see all of those political threads converging in this story around Gaetz?
You know, it is remarkably ironic when you think about all these pieces. I have found it very interesting that, you know, Matt Gaetz was not popular in D.C. He, you know, has been enjoyed his status as kind of a firebrand, as you described him, and a bit of an outsider. But it is remarkable how few GOP allies are really speaking out on his behalf. And Politico has done some reporting about this, and it's really interesting to see how these Republicans have been keeping quiet. However, nobody has come out quite to criticize him either, except yesterday after the Daily Beast reporting came out, Illinois Republican Adam Kinzinger, who's quite often a frequent critic of his own party and members of his own party, he was the first to call on Matt Gaetz to resign. I think that all of this is just going to continue to drip out. The thing I found especially interesting with yesterday's reporting is the fact that they named some more Tallahassee names. That included former DBPR secretary who Halsey Bashirs, mm-hmm. and a longtime Republican lobbyist Chris Dorworth,
who were allegedly on that Bahamian trip that is under investigation.
Actually, Dorworth wasn't on that trip.
He was not on the trip. Okay, the lobbyist wasn't, but the former secretary was reported to be on the trip.
He was Mary Ellen, a lawmaker at the time.
Yeah. You spoke about kind of Gaetz on Capitol Hill. What about in the district, in the panhandle? Any kind of support that he has received as these headlines have come out, or generally the kind of support that he has in his district?
Well, he has had some support. There is a state rep, Andre, who is, I think, interested in running for Congress if Matt Gaetz does step down or resigns. And he's come out in support of Gaetz. But it's interesting, you know, the way that Panhandle is kind of a big small town in a way. It's my understanding that Andre's wife works for the law firm that Gaetz was highly critical of when he was criticizing the claim that his extortion claims against he and his father. Mm-hmm. There have not been a lot of outspoken supporters of him. On the other hand, people are up there generally supportive of him.
Yeah, the extortion part of this story we haven't explored yet, even in the conversation. It's yet another wrinkle in all of this. Let me remind folks that you're listening to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio.
Now, Mark Caputo, the more lurid parts of the allegations have gotten most of the ink, most of the attention. But can you talk a little bit as well about the fact that we're told federal authorities are looking into Gaetz's other activities here in the state, like whether he talked about running a fake candidate in a Florida Senate race to allegedly skew the results. There's more to this probe. What do we know about what they're looking at?
I am deeply skeptical that they're doing that looking into. To begin with, there's not much federal space there. We're talking about state Senate, number one. Number two, the people and person spreading the story that Gaetz and his friend had this conversation of establishing a dummy candidate, that's Greenberg. And it's an example of Greenberg's legal team throwing as much pasta at the wall to see what sticks. And so I would steer people away from that aspect of
the investigation. But you bring up such an important point, though, which is that Greenberg is likely to do a plea deal. That's not good news for Matt Gaetz.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's terrible news for Matt Gaetz. Don't get me wrong. Yeah, I don't want to make it look like Matt Gaetz is in the clear. There are a number of Gaetz's friends who thought he was not going to be indicted, who are increasingly believing. I would imagine Gaetz is pretty clear eyed in a lot of these things, although his behavior might lead some people to believe otherwise. He has, I think, been looking at kind of at the how this plays out in the future and working his way back. And he appears to be ready to be indicted and to fight it all the way. And, in his mind to win. That again, circling back to what I said earlier, will be, kind of discussing Greenberg's credibility issues. But yeah, Greenberg certainly has a lot of text messages. There are a lot of Venmo and Cash App exchanges between Gates, Greenberg, and federal prosecutors like to get big quarry. And Matt Gaetz is big game here on the public corruption Serengeti.
All right. Now, on that safari, to take a bit of a detour here, Mary Ellen, you referred to this conspiracy that Congressman Gaetz kind of put out for some kind of not defense per se, but I suppose an explanation or a story. Just, we've only got about 90 seconds before we have to break, so quickly, if you could, Mary Ellen, but describe what this part of the story relates to him and his father, a former Senate president in the Florida legislature.
Well, it boils down to an extortion claim by Matt Gaetz, and in which there is an Iranian hostage whose family has recently indicated that they believe he's dead after years of searches of him. Mm-hmm. And there's a Pensacola lawyer who's a former U.S. attorney who has been engaged in trying to raise some money to continue that search. And he allegedly, according to the Gaetz family, approached Don Gaetz, who's a multimillionaire billionaire, and asked them to help finance this. And in the process, suggested that because there's rumors that your son is under investigation, this might look good for you to do something noble. And that's where this extortion claim comes from.
Yeah, talking about the investigation into Panhandle Republican Congressman Matt Gaetz with Mary Ellen Kloss, the Miami Herald, Mark Caputo with Politico. We're going to talk about environmental politics next. You're listening to the Florida Roundup on Florida Public Radio. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
Millions of gallons of polluted water have been pumped this week from a Manatee County phosphate plant retention pond into Tampa Bay.
A leak was found there in the pond last week, and that raised concerns that the earthen walls could actually collapse. Now, the state had been releasing up to 50 million gallons of wastewater a day to prevent that from happening.
Yeah, they wanted to avoid what was called a wall of water. On Thursday, the state reduced the flow down to 5 million gallons a day. The Florida Department of Environmental Protection says they will treat the water now before releasing it into the waters of Tampa Bay.
Now, here's the problem. The water isn't radioactive, but it is filled with nutrients that can cause those harmful algae blooms. And that algae can then have a detrimental domino effect on an entire body of waters ecosystem. Here's Assistant Director for the Tampa Bay Estuary Program, Maya Burke.
When we have too much algae in the water in Tampa Bay, it shades out the ability of seagrasses to grow and thrive. And we know that seagrasses are really the foundation of a healthy Tampa Bay. So we're always concerned when we see this much of a nutrient load going into the bay.
So let's talk about this Piney Point leak and the environmental money and politics around this. Are you concerned about the environmental impacts the releases of polluted water will have on Tampa Bay? 305-995-1800, 305-995-1800, or on Twitter at Florida Roundup.
The Miami Herald's Mary Ellen Kloss and Mark Caputo of Politico are still here with us. And Jessica Mazzaros from WUSF in Tampa now joins the conversation. Jessica, thanks for being with us. You've been covering Piney Point heavily. There are 24 retention ponds similar to the one in Piney Point. Can you tell us what purpose they serve for the phosphate mining industry?
As I understand, it's meant to hold on to a byproduct of phosphate mining. And, you know, we're getting updates from the Florida Department of Environmental Protection around 5 p.m. every day. And the latest from them on Piney Point is that so far, about 202 million gallons of water have been discharged into Tampa Bay, and that leaves about 232 million gallons left.
And can you explain why the environmental concern is of such pressing interest right now? Algae blooms are nothing new in Florida, but this would be a really big infusion, right, into Tampa Bay?
Right. This is according to one expert, actually Maya Burke, who you just aired a cut from her, she was saying to me that if all of this water ends up in the bay, it would be three times the amount of this kind of a spill that we've ever seen in the bay. So we actually, it's unprecedented and wouldn't know what that would look like. And also the amount of nitrogen coming out would eventually be a year's worth for the bay in just a week or two. And of course, those nutrients could feed harmful algae blooms, but I don't think we've ever seen nutrients like this.
Mary Ellen Klass, Tallahassee and the Senate specifically is responding this week, wanting to earmark tens of millions of dollars to help clean this up. But this problem didn't just surface over the weekend. This pollution, this polluted water has been known to be a potential disaster in waiting in Manatee County for a good number of years. Describe, you know, what has been the state response to this and historically and kind of what we learned this week as this, quote, wall of water was threatening these communities.
Well, it's really a pretty long, lengthy history, and it's a lot of people turning their heads for a long time. You know, the Piney Point phosphate plant was built, I guess, in about in the 60s. And it was, the company ultimately went bankrupt. It became a state responsibility to do something with it. And in 2001, the Department of Environmental Protection then decided it was time to clean it up and close it. The state in, I think between 2004 and 2011, allocated about $124 million to cleanup, but it never happened. And we learned this week from the Department of Environmental Protection Secretary Noah Valenstein, who told the Senate that basically the state was just never really committed to fully closing it. In other words, regulators just kind of sat on their hands. And so this is what happened with that kind of delay. We're now facing the consequences.
Yeah. Mark Caputo, you know, the environmental group Ocean Conservancy, they emailed Florida Roundup right before we went on the air. They said they're working with others on a rapid response effort to deal with these algae blooms. And they point out as hurricane season gets underway and the water warms up, it could be a harmful algae bloom situation of epic proportions. So it could be just truly an environmental catastrophe for the bay. At the same time, what do we know about the owners of this plant? What can you tell us?
Well, I must admit that is where I don't have a lot of expertise in the area of that. I'm more familiar with the history of how this plant started to what Mary Ellen was talking about.
And so it's a history of, it sounds like, lax oversight maybe over the years.
Well, in part, yeah. Like, so for instance, I just went back to the last Democrat who was governor, and that was Lawton Childs, and decided to look forward, because one of the things that you've heard about is that this is a legacy of sort of Republican laissez-faire regulation. And that by and large bears out to be true, but there's just a lot of blame to go around. In 1995, the Manatee County, where this is located, they had their own local environmental protection agency, and they decided to let it lapse, and they put it in the hands of the state DEP. And as a lot of people sarcastically tell you, DEP means don't expect protection. And subsequently, since that, just in going through the news clips over the years, I've just been kind of astonished at how the state has allowed this ticking time bomb to just, you know, slowly have its fuse burn. And maybe that's a bad analogy because this is water and not fire, but this is one of those things that's just been inevitable. There was also a phosphate leak after one of the hurricanes in the 2003-2004 hurricane season, 2004-2005 hurricane season. It's a massive, massive problem in that area of Florida. And unfortunately, Florida regulators, Florida politicians, and to a great degree, Florida voters, don't pay any attention to this stuff until it's too late. So yeah, the Ocean Conservancy can come up with these great plans to clean everything up, but the solution here is to not get in a situation where, you know, once the horse is out of the barn, to try to go catch it.
Yeah.
Because by then, it's just way too late.
The leak's already happened. We're talking about the Piney Point leak here on the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio.
Yeah, the risk in this part is the polluted water out of the retention pond as opposed to the horse out of the barn. But Jessica Mazaros, what can you tell us about the owner of this site? It's a private company. It's not a state site. And as Mary Ellen and Mark have all pointed out, you know, this polluted water is not new. It's been there for a good number of years, and the owner and others have known.
Right. So HRK Holdings is the owner, and one of my colleagues did a recent report highlighting that they have a spotty environmental and financial record, as was mentioned. After they bought the land in 2006 from the state, they promised to clean up the site, but instead eventually allowed Port Manatee to dump dredging waste into one of the three retention ponds there. Then an investigation by the Bradenton Herald found that HRK knew about a previous tear in the pond's plastic lining back in 2011 and never told local officials about it. And as a result, released about 170 million gallons of toxic water into Tampa Bay. And they couldn't afford to clean it up, so that left them to file for bankruptcy.
Mm. Jessica, with the dumping that's been happening, the pumping that's been happening this week to reduce the water level, when could Tampa Bay residents, neighbors see the impact in the water if there is going to be an impact?
Yeah, some scientists say it could be a couple weeks before we see any algae blooms as a result of the excess nutrients. And also, as for knowing how much of the nutrients are actually in the bay right now, a team of scientists from the USF College of Marine Science took some samples on Wednesday, but they don't expect to have the full results for days or even weeks because they say some chemicals take longer to process. And, you know, as we speak, more water is flowing in. So by the time we get those results, that data will have likely changed.
Mary Ellen Kloss, people letting us know here on the show that there was a similar leak a few years ago in Lake Okeechobee. It killed a bunch of fish, they say. You know, the St. John's River in Jacksonville has long had a problem with really ugly and environmentally devastating algae blooms that kill fish. In the 2 minutes we have left, this is a scourge for the state of Florida. So the Piney Point leak is the latest in a long line of examples.
Yeah, and I think it's exacerbated by warming temperatures and growing population. We are seeing a little bit of a focus on some of the origins of these microscopic, you know, damaging microscopic plants that interfere with and contribute to algae blooms, with this emphasis on a new septic to sewer infrastructure plan coming out of the legislature this session. But it's really just a tip of the beginning of the solution. And there needs to be a lot more focus on this, and it will continue to be a perpetual problem for this state.
Mark Caputo, just 30 seconds here, but, you know, squaring this with early in the DeSantis administration, he was getting a lot of accolades from environmentalists with funding for environmental projects.
Yeah, time to put up. You know, it's not just environmentalists. I'm the stepson of a commercial fisherman in the Keys.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And a lot of them liked what he said about controlling toxic algae blooms and pollution. And this is a time where Ron DeSantis's rhetoric about making a Florida kind of a cleaner, better place to recreate, to fish, to live, and balance that with the needs and interests of the industry are going to come to a head. It'll be interesting to see how he handles that.
Yeah, water is big politics. It's big money. It's recreation. It's big business, and really underpins the economy and development here throughout Florida. Mark Caputo, writer for and reporter for Politico. Always great to have you on. And Mary Ellen Kloss, the Capitol Bureau Chief at the Miami Herald in Tallahassee. To both of you, thanks for joining us on the roundup this week.
Along with Jessica Mazaros, thank you as well. And that's our show, The Florida Roundup, produced by WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Heather Schatz and Andrea Padormo are the show producers.
Jason Zabka is the WLRN Director of Radio Programming, WLRN's Director of Radio Operations, and our Technical Director is Peter Meritz. Engineering help each and every week from Doug Peterson, Charles Michaels, and Josh Torres. Our theme music provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at aaronlibos.com. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. Have a great weekend. We'll be back next Friday.